Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. After some time away to welcome my firstborn into the world, talk about facing my own future, I am back and will be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, Stuart Butler, and Tim Higashi, a Research Analyst also at Brookings. The centerpiece of today's program is a recent forum co-hosted by Brookings and the Millennial Action Project that explored how millennials think differently about climate change and the national debt. Tim and Stuart will discuss in detail takeaways from the forum and the research behind their findings. We'll be back after these short messages.
Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Stuart Butler and Bob Bixby. Bob, you know well. He's the Concord Coalition's Executive Director. Stuart is a Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob and Stuart.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chase. Welcome back to the show yourself.
I was going to say, I'm happy to be back as well, and I'm certainly glad to kick off my return from a hiatus with the two of you talking about what I think is a really, really interesting panel discussion that Brookings helped facilitate recently on some really important topics. And just to give a recap for our listeners, Brookings and the Millennial Action Project hosted a panel on millennials' attitudes towards the national debt and climate change. And I think I'll kick it right over to you, Stuart, and ask, how did this panel come together and why?
Well, the reason is that I think we've all discovered that it's really a difficult job trying to get younger Americans really kind of worked up about the issue of long-term debt and deficits. And we kind of observed, like we all have, that there are other issues where there seems to be no problem getting younger Americans involved. And one in particular is the whole issue of climate change. And the interesting thing about it, of course, is if you look at debt and deficit issues and you look at climate change, they are both examples of problems that are sort of in the future, could be very devastating, both of them, where you would need to take action now to forestall that problem. And yet, while there's such activity in the area of climate change, it's very difficult, as I said, to get people, younger people worked up about the debt and deficit. So the intent of this event was really to try to get to the bottom of this. We brought in people who really look at public attitudes by generations, the Pew Foundation. We brought in the Millennial Action Project as a co-sponsor, and they work with younger members of Congress. So that was an important angle. And we brought in an organization called Frameworks, which Frameworks Institute, which looks at how to frame issues for different generations and different populations. So it really was an attempt to really talk through why it is that you see such concern about one issue and not about the other, and what lessons that we could learn in trying to get greater public attention on debts and debt and deficits from the experience that there's been in climate change.
And Stuart, you moderated that conversation. So what was that dynamic like for you trying to identify points of crossover? I mean, you mentioned that both of these issues are long-term issues that can have a serious impact on our nation, on the world, on generations. So when you were crafting the questions for that conversation, what were you hoping to achieve? What were the goals and the questions you were going to ask?
I think I was really trying to draw out attitudes among younger Americans that would be surprising to to people of my age. I'm a baby boomer, and I was the only baby boomer on the stage. And so,
it's an unusual thing for a lone baby boomer.
Exactly. And so I was trying to kind of draw this out and sort of what is it that we of a somewhat older generation kind of take as a given? What is it that doesn't strike a chord with people who are younger, and what can we learn from that? And there were several things that did come out. I mean, for example, I'm 72 years old. I've experienced long periods of inflation, of high interest rates, of the kinds of problems that those of us who are older kind of immediately think of when we think of the problem, the potential problem of debt and deficits. The people on the stage, generally speaking, had experienced none of that. So one of the things that really came through, first of all, is that you've got to understand the learned experience, if you like, of different generations. Millennials just do not have the same experience and therefore the same fears that many older Americans have. I think also that there's a tendency for those of us who are in the baby boom generation to sound like we're sort of crying wolf. And we're saying, you know, the sky's about to fall all the time. And younger people, I think, get very skeptical of that. They don't see any examples of this. Yes, we've had the Great Recession, a short, very sharp shock. But we got over that pretty quickly. So we don't have, people don't have that experience. And that's really important in terms of trustworthiness of people making the case for taking action on the debt and deficit. Younger people just don't see the phenomena that we are constantly warning about. They don't see it in their everyday life. But on the other hand, they see wildfires, they see hurricanes, they see things that may or may not be related to long-term climate change, but it looks like it. And so I think we've got to understand that. And then I think we've got to understand that, related to that, it's hard to sort of build trust among younger people to take action which is painful when there's skepticism about the people bringing the message. Look, I'm an economist at the Brookings Institution. I've learned the hard way that economists are not necessarily treated with as godlike figures by people. We disagree with each other. We're often wrong. And so we've got to understand that. Whereas when you look at the climate change issue, you do see people that have got credibility in this issue. Everything from movie stars who just take this on as an issue to the local weatherman on your television. I learned from this conversation that whereas I, as somebody in my 70s, think of the weatherman is a bit of a joke. I come from England, so they're even a bigger joke in England. It's always raining and so on.
But I live in New Hampshire.
Well, you understand very well what I'm talking about. So I don't think of the weatherman as being a really trustworthy expert on these issues. But that's not true with younger people, both just the experience that they have with what's going on in the weather, but also the techniques, the technology. It's very different today. So we've got to think differently about how we build trust and the evidence and the trustworthiness of people warning younger people about this debt and deficit. We may be looking for different people than economists.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and I'm going to have him jump in just a second. We're also talking to Stuart Butler, an economist and senior fellow at Brookings. We're discussing a recent panel discussing how millennials think differently about climate change and the national debt. And I wanted to piggyback off of something you were just discussing there, Stuart, and that is this learned experience gap almost between baby boomers and younger generations, just in the difference of experiences each generation has had. Is it possible, from your view, to bridge that learned experience gap in order to draw millennials in to addressing these issues?
Yes, I think it is. And I think we learned a lot about this actually on the panel itself. I do think that one of the lessons we certainly learn is that this is the debt and deficit issue is not as plausible to younger people as a sort of a crisis that's suddenly going to appear. They think about this, they think of a crisis when it comes to climate change, but not about debt and deficit. They just are skeptical. So trying to make that argument that just a few weeks away, we may have a catastrophe economically, it does not get through to people. And I think that a better message that actually one of my colleagues here at Brookings often uses, Isabel Sawhill, says you've got to really make the argument that it's more like termites in the woodwork than a sudden hurricane appearing financially, if you like, and point out to people how over time the issue of the deficit and debt could erode their situation. And I think you can strike a chord with people, with younger people on that. Many younger people have large college debt. They think about how over time this is going to reduce their flexibility to buy a house, to take risks, and so on. And I think pointing out that debt and deficits in the long term may or may not have a potentially catastrophic economic effect, but they certainly box in or crowd out, if you like, almost the ability of younger people to make decisions in the future. The bigger that debt is, the less room the government has to deal with issues that are important to them, education, climate change, other things like that. And to make that kind of argument is more likely to get traction than the sort of the fear concern, the idea that there may be a catastrophe just around the corner.
Stuart, you mentioned Bell Sawhill. You and I and Bell and David Walker, who was Comptroller General of the United States at the time, started a fiscal wake-up tour back in 2005
right.
And really did it for about 5 years. And, you know, the premise of that was that experts from different points of view could disagree about solutions, but we all agreed on the facts, and we all agreed that this was a problem that the nation needed to address. You know, as I was reading through the forum, listening to the forum, one of the things that struck me is, you know, maybe we had the wrong message, or maybe if we were to do that today, how would you frame the message differently mm-hmm. than we did? Because basically we were issuing a warning then. We were talking about bad things might happen in the future. And you got into some reframing in a more positive sense in this forum, and I was very right. intrigued by that.
Well, let me just say, first of all, and with regard to the fiscal wake-up tour, even there, we actually modified the way we framed it to different populations. We were talking, as you know, mainly to groups of people that consist both of younger people and older people. But, I mean, one of the things we did was, first of all, to agree not to disagree about the numbers. I think that's really important because we might have had differences of opinion about exactly what the projections look like, but we all agreed that they were pretty dire.
And I should say, at that time, you were at Heritage.
That's right. I was at a conservative institution.
Conservative, and
Brookings
Bell
was considered
Bell was
at least a more liberal institution. But we said, look, the thing we agree on, the central message, is so clear that let's not let people sort of divide us over the details. That's an issue we still have today in general in this debate. There's enough of a disagreement among economists that that it allows people who are skeptics to say, well, I can discount that then. So it's very important, first of all, I think, for us to look at the, even where there's disagreement among economists, to really make clear where that there's a pretty narrow set of boundary in terms of how we think about the future. I think, secondly, as we did again in the fiscal wake-up tool, we try to translate this into, you know, out of billions and trillions, and into something very tangible for people, and the less sort of economic problem and more how are you ever going to afford all the other things if you've got this debt as well.
If you talk about the things that you won't be able to do if we don't do this, or do you talk about the things that you will be able to do if we are if we knock down this debt?
You know, that's a very good point, which we didn't get into quite as much as I would have wanted. But this issue about losing as opposed to the benefits of solving the problem, there's certainly a lot of conversation. There was among some of the experts there and in their other work that when you look at the future, to be able to say, if we solve this problem, then you will be able to do this. For younger people, often is much more persuasive than to say, if we don't solve this problem, this is the downside. Actually, as a relatively older person, I tend to be much more typically of people my age risk averse. We've seen bad things in the past. We've seen long periods of economic problems, unemployment, and things like this. We tend to be more sensitive as a generation to the fear of losing something than younger people are. Younger people often think, yeah, they're going to lose. Things are not going to work out, but then there'll be another day and so forth. So I think the evidence from our conversation was it's important to focus a bit more on the positive of if we solve this problem, this will what you will be able to do, including things like solving other issues.
Right.
Like it's climate change. You know, yeah, I think they're linked like
this.
The
thing. Yeah, it's more like the quote-unquote pain that's involved in deficit reduction is not done for its own sake. It's you know, you paint the picture of the brighter future, and then how do you get there? Well, here are some options that you might want to do now. And that doesn't give an upfront message of, okay, the first thing you need to do is have a root canal.
That's right. That doesn't play well, especially when they're suspicious of the dentist.
Yeah. Well, this prompts for me the question of the politics of it all. Because it seems like my generation, I am a millennial, and like any millennial getting a late start to a lot of things in life, like having a child or buying a house. But my generation tends to take a more concrete look at plans to address things like climate change. But we allow the conversation about concrete plans to address fiscal policy issues to get caught up in the muck and the mire of political rhetoric. Do you see a particular reason for that, or is there a way to eventually cut through that rhetoric and get my generation on board with concrete plans?
Well, I think that the disagreement among economists, the difficulty of pointing to sort of phenomena that are sort of, you know, presaging what exactly is going to happen in the future, that it's harder with this issue. So I do think focusing on concrete plans makes a lot of sense, and of course, as we discovered in the conversation, if you look at something like climate change, one of the things that younger Americans really feel impelled to do is do something themselves in some way to look at their carbon footprint, you know, to think about turning down the thermostat and so forth. And now, I as an economist might say, well, that's going to make hardly any difference, you know. But the fact is that is important to younger people. So that's why when I was thinking about this, I thought it's really important to say things like, you know, a tangible step must be to increase savings, to look at how can we build more savings among younger people. How can younger people take steps that will reduce the need they might have for Medicare or their, you know, in the future and so on, to take concrete steps to improve lifestyle, economic steps and so on, to really show as an individual what the country should be doing as a whole. I think that's an important piece of this. This is both a left and a right brain issue. You've got to have people feeling that they've got a commitment, that they have a visceral sort of a connection with this, that they're taking steps themselves, as well as looking at the big policy pictures as well. Both are necessary, I think, to generate interest among younger Americans.
It sounded like a lot of the things you were recommending sort of as the what can you do, what positive step can be made for millennials are very personal, almost individually focused. How can I increase savings? How can I increase investment? How can I, you know, prepare for having a child? Relative to, it almost seems like in past generations, there was a much bigger collective, like what can we do to improve X, or what can the nation do to achieve Y? Is that just a perception in my mind, or is there any research to back that up?
No, I think it's much more than a perception. I think we see this very much with millennials and younger Americans, the feeling that they can't trust big action by we, essentially, if that's the government or the economy or the business sector or something. They've got to do something themselves. That's a very strong feeling in these younger generations, I've learned, than in the case of baby boomers. And I think that the connection I'd also like to make is that if you can persuade people to take tangible first steps in the economic area, like savings, like planning for the future. And that causes them to go and see the financial advisor, the person who's making the projections for them. Then it does, in fact, put much more into their consciousness the importance of long-term policy in this area. If you're talking to somebody about their health needs and you're raising, as a financial advisor, pointing out to them that the cost associated with Medicare, the out-of-pocket associated with Medicare as it's currently structured, you bring home to them that these long-term programs are not well positioned for the baby boomers and younger people. If you show them that what's going to happen to their student debt if interest rates increase, because if you're making projections, a trusted advisor has to build in, as we know, different scenarios, build in more historical interest rates. That really hits home very quickly with younger people. So I do think that encouraging younger people to take personal action will lead them to very quickly understand that the public policy scenario we have, the we piece, if you like, of dealing with these issues is not in place, is not, you know, not adequate, and might well impel them to go from not only taking personal actions themselves, but to be much more vocal in encouraging the we, the government, the larger population, to address some of these longer-term factors that make it difficult for them as younger people to plan for the future, to take the tangible steps that they're inclined to do to try to solve a problem.
Well, that's exactly what we do on this show, planning for the future, because this is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Stuart Butler, a senior fellow at Brookings. We discussed a recent panel discussion on how millennials think differently about climate change and the national debt, and we started jumping into how we can try and make the connection for my generation to start acting on these fiscal policy challenges our nation is facing. Thank you both for joining the show.
Thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Up next, I'll be joined by Tim Higashi, a senior research analyst in economic studies at Brookings. We'll dig a little deeper on these issues. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Tim Higashi and Bob Bixby. Bob, you know very well, he's a regular contributor on the show. Tim is a senior research analyst in economic studies at Brookings, and we're picking up off of our last segment with Stuart Butler, talking about a recent panel discussion on the topic of climate change, national fiscal policy. Before we do that, I guess I should do the appropriate thing and welcome our guest to the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Chase.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Happy to have you both. And Tim, we were just talking offline a little bit about what your role is in all of this. You're a fellow millennial with me. Bob is indeed outnumbered now in this segment. So maybe describe for our listeners what you do at Brookings and some of the research you've done on these key issues.
Yeah, so glad to be here. Here at Brookings, my portfolio covers budget and economic policy, and I worked a lot on this event, so I'm really happy. I'm also happy to be joined by another millennial on this issue. Seems to be two of us for sure focused on this, less and less than we'd hoped. But about a year ago, my boss Stuart and I began to ask this question, trying to figure out why climate change, which was another long-term problem, was getting more attention by millennials and Generation Z than the debt, even though the problems sort of shared a very similar challenge. We kind of called them long-term problems in a short-term world. A lot of millennials and Generation Z have much shorter time horizons, and they think, you know, they're less future oriented. So about, you know, a year ago, we began to think about this question. And in particular, we identified a group called the Millennial Action Project, with whom we co-hosted this large forum in October. And together with the Millennial Action Project and their Congressional Future Caucus, which is comprised of members who are under 45-ish, we, you know, started to ask this question. How do we communicate these long-term problems such as debt, climate change to future generations such that they actually take action or there's motivation to do something? So, you know, about a year ago, we, you know, asked that question and began to build up the necessary steps to put on the event and do the background research. Stuart mentioned a lot of really key, important things to that. We had heavy involvement with the Pew Foundation, two scholars there who really helped us understand at a granular level how millennials and Generation Z think about climate change and how they think about national debt and deficit. And to see those parallels was really interesting, and hopefully we can talk about that. And the second group with whom we engaged a lot was the Frameworks Institute, and their focus is really looking at the science or the sociological impact of communicating and how you frame things such that you can get, you know, people to do something about it. So we're really pleased with the effort. We've had a lot of really positive responses and members and offices and other organizations, and we're pleased to continue to talk about it.
Well, I think the point you just underscored there, Tim, is probably where we should start, and that is how do millennials think about climate change and the national debt? What did your research reveal?
Well, I will say that, you know, admittedly, our public opinion expert is with Pew, and so I'm speaking as a secondhand observer here. But, you know, firstly, we can clearly state that millennials and Generation Z are more concerned about climate than they are about debt. However, there is not universal agreement on climate change, even among millennials. I think an interesting finding that our Pew presenter showed was that 56% of millennials would attribute climate change to something human caused, and that is a significant, you know, amount. But again, that, you know, that's not a, you know, a huge majority. I mean, there's still 44% of the population that's not convinced, you know, that that's an issue. So, although climate change is much more salient and resonates much more with millennials and Generation Z, that it is not a, you know, it's not a, an ex, a full exclusive value and perspective shared by millennials. Now, contrasting that, when you look at the national debt and deficit, this is the more discouraging news. I think on the Pew side, what they found is really it's really hardly registers on the millennial and Generation Z radar, particularly when it's framed in the long-term debt and deficit problem. They kind millennials and Generation Z, it's interesting, you know, we've seen the longest run of economic growth we've experienced in our history came after a time of, you know, a deep recession and then, you know, significant stimulus spending. You know, so we're kind of, millennials are kind of on this thinking that, okay, if debt and deficit are bad, then why did we have such long-run economic growth? In fact, some of the longest in our history, following a period of, you know, deficit and debt growth. And that is, that. So, you know, millennials and Generation Z have a different perspective. And I think Stuart articulated this well. They're, you know, our life experience is much different than, you know, perhaps the baby boomers or other generations on this.
Like a lot of issues, there's a political divide. Almost one party believes one thing, another party believes another. Does the research show that it's another political divide, or does this cut across what would be the typical Republican or Democratic stance on the issues?
Yeah, it's a great question, Chase. I won't say authoritatively on this, and I would really refer your listeners to Pew's work, and in particular Kim Parker and Alex Tyson have done work on this. I'll refer the listeners to that work to get a completely accurate sense of this. But I believe there is a difference politically on this. And I would say it in two. I would present it in two ways. First, when you look at Democrats and Republicans, generally speaking, across all age cohorts, there is a difference. Democrats are more likely to believe that climate change and global warming is human caused. Republicans, on the other hand, are less likely to believe that. I think the Democrats are above 70%. And I can't recall the figure off the top of my head on the Republican side. But when you segment the population by age cohort, there's an interesting finding. Although Republicans generally across all age cohorts are less likely to believe that climate change is human-caused, when you look at it among younger millennial age Republicans, both Generation Z and millennials, you have more younger Republicans or younger self-identified Republicans are more likely to believe that climate change is, human caused, and there's a human factor involved there. So I think there's a two parts there. But I again would encourage your listeners to check out Alex Tyson and Kim Parker's work at the Pew Foundation.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and Tim Higashi from Brookings. We're discussing the research behind a recent panel discussion on how millennials think differently about climate change and national debt. And that was hosted by Brookings and the Millennial Action Project. And Tim, you were talking there a bit about the political differences here, the age cohort differences here. And you earlier had mentioned that national debt budget deficits barely register in terms of any real concern when it comes to the perspective of a millennial. But I'm wondering if that's really about how the topic is framed. Mm-hmm. So if we were to frame the issue, say, in healthcare and its impact on the budget or infrastructure investment or defense, do those numbers change at all? Or is this really just something that millennials throw their hands up in the air because of the political brinksmanship and they just walk away?
It's a great idea. I think the Concord Coalition has done some of this work, so I'm encouraged to hear you thinking about that. Chase, I definitely think that when the long-term debt and deficit are reframed, this is something that Stuart talked about in the previous few minutes, when the deficit and debt are reframed toward the future, there's much more traction or there's much more willingness, according to the research, for millennials and Generation Z to actually do something about it. So I think it was well said earlier, it's better to say to millennials, or it's better to say to future generations, you can do this, X. You can address climate change. You can invest in infrastructure. You can invest in education if you take care of the debt, as opposed to millennials. If millennials do not address the long-term debt, they will not have Social Security payments in the future. That does not, according to the research, motivate young people to kind of do this. I think I've read something that you all, Concord Coalition, had put out about an intergenerational primer on the long-term debt. And I think one graph that you had there that struck a chord with me was showing the net interest on the debt costs being compared to our spending as a percentage of GDP on education, I think it was defense and non-defense R&D. So when you frame those together and show, this net interest on the debt cost is higher than our spending on what we, put into schools and K-12 education, being able to frame it in that way and showing that perspective also might be another way to get traction among millennials and Generation Z.
And Tim, this may get to the framing concept we're sort of diving into here, but you mentioned a phrase that piqued my interest earlier, and that is the social science of communicating with millennials. Can you talk a little bit about what research reveals there? Like, how do you effectively communicate with a millennial?
We should ask Bob this question.
I've been wondering that for a while.
Oh, you got to.
I'm taking notes here.
Stuart says, my boss says, you have to text them or tweet at them, even if they're in the same room. I think, as a millennial, and also Chase, I understand that you are as well. I would say, an important thing to note is that millennials and Generation Z are less likely to trust big institutions. So when you think about the science of framing this, I'll pick up on something Stuart mentioned about the trusted weatherman. When you think about how to frame these things, an important element and consideration in that is really who the messenger is, or who is the person that's presenting this topic, or who's the person that's presenting the long-term debt and the deficit problem. the Frameworks Institute, what's really, really interesting about what they do is they really take up this notion that understanding a problem or understanding an issue such as the debt is really is frame dependent. Depending on how you frame the issue, that will really impact how people respond to it. How do we communicate and how do we frame this so that young people really care and are willing to do something about it?
I do think that that's the big challenge, because what we have been doing, the baby boomers, aside from running up big debt, but the way that we talk about it is simply not getting through. And I think you touched on something that I think is really important, which is the life experiences of the millennial generation don't show any indication that debt has any consequence. Been, racking up huge debts. You know, I think just talking about bad things are going to happen if we keep on this track is nothing more than like an academic exercise,
right,
I guess,
right,
for people in your generation. That having been said, I'd like to just ask both of you, I mean, what makes you guys the exception? I mean, the issue, fiscal responsibility debt, obviously resonated with both of you at some point. Why?
Yeah, Chase, you want to take a crack at it first?
Is that because I work on the issue and I've been doing this for like 6 years?
Yeah, but I hired you for a reason. You were interested in this a long time ago, right out of law school.
Well, look, I know. And, you know, it's difficult for me because I don't, this is going to sound a bit conceited and it's not really meant to, but I feel like I'm a bit of an old soul in that I think a lot more about the long term, about past and future generations. I kind of have an old school mentality on, you know, the fact that we should pay for things that we want to do. But then I'm very much an advocate of investing in the future. Like, there are certainly things that we need to invest in, we need to plan for, we need to set up future generations for success. And I'm not a big fan of, you know, watching generations ahead of us get those advantages and the millennials not have those same advantages. So there's a bit of a fairness aspect to it. But I think for me, I studied finance in college, went to law school. I'm kind of an analytical thinker on all of this. So I look at what adds up and what doesn't. And when I see something not adding up, I want to fix it. I want to make it better. I want to make tweaks to it. And I'm very matter of fact in that regard. So I have, I think, an internal drive that attracts me to these issues. I don't know about you, Tim. What do you think?
Well, I think we need to find more old soul millennials. That's what I'm taking away from this.
There you go.
I think similarly, as Chase just articulated, having an economics background and a public finance background, you're more attuned to this, and these arguments are more germane and more salient because we're, consciously thinking about this. And in my particular role, working with House and Senate offices, working with the administration on this. There's a resonance there that I can see, But I do think, Bob, you make an excellent reiteration of this point that our generation has experienced debt and deficit in actually a positive way, which is just completely in contrast to how other generations have experienced it. I mean, this was, I'll give credit to there was an intern with the Millennial Action Project who first mentioned this in one of our roundtable meetings, and it just really floored me. You know, we have seen the longest run of economic growth basically after, a deep recession and a lot of deficit and debt-financed spending. We really shouldn't think that this is this is a problem that needs to be addressed. In fact, we might think, wow, this is an excellent tool, perhaps, or an excellent loop in the system that we've figured out here. You know, there's some economists that have been writing about this. If we have the reserve currency and we're borrowing in our currency, that there might be a possibility that this could go on, not indefinitely. And I won't even say this on the program because I don't want to give the listeners any sense that that's possible. but there is that notion, and that I would say that comports with the experience of millennials and Generation Z.
That's what scares the hell out of me about what's going on now. Just because, I always took it for granted that, one should have some that there would be consequences to fiscal irresponsibility. And most everybody, I mean, during the 80s and when we ran up big deficits then, and certainly in the 90s, there was a big public reaction to it. Democrats and Republicans would disagree maybe about the solutions, the level of taxes, the level of government involvement in the economy and spending. But nobody disagreed about the fact that if you ran big deficits, that would have a negative impact on the economy. You'd run up huge interest costs. What we're getting now is interest costs have been very low. Mm-hmm. And so we keep warning about, when these interest rates go back up to quote-unquote normal levels. And we are very vulnerable to that, but interest rates stay, to my mind, what look like, and for baby boomers, they just look like these are just unbelievably low interest. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I can remember going to a real estate agent and being told, hey, this is great. You can get a 14% rate on your loan. and that was considered good. You know, they're coming down, so let's lock that in right away, you know? You guys don't have that.
Yeah.
But that's why from our generation, you see all this huge debt. And the reason that we're paying more interest every year in the budget is not because interest rates are a problem, but because of the metastasizing amount of
mm-hmm.
debt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's the life experiences and getting that sense of that there are limits.
I'll tie all of this together with a quick statement, then we have to go. But old generation statement, our chickens will eventually come home to roost.
Mm-hmm.
If we continue trying to tweak things in the margins and not make significant reform, you know, no matter what theory you're operating under, eventually something breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
So in my view, we're missing a major, major opportunity, both economically and generationally, from the millennial perspective, because we're not close to retirement. We're in our prime working years. This is when the reform needs to happen. And at the same time, our economy has been growing steadily, slowly, but steadily, for over a decade. You know, we are missing the sweet spot for making changes without significantly harming future generations. And that, I think, is what upsets me most about all this right now.
Let me just add one thing on a little positive note. you know, one other thing I'd mention about climate change that we kind of learn when you crosswalk these two is individuals feel that they have personal agency over, you know, the warming of the globe or other things like that on the climate change space. And therefore, they're willing to do things such as, buy a hybrid car, no longer use plastic straws and things like that. You know, a question we've been asking ourselves is how do we present this so that one can personally make a difference in the debt and in the long-term deficit? And Stuart mentioned some good options, you know, which was related to a savings account and that kind of thing. But what we found in the climate change research, which I think is really instructive for the debt and deficit, is that although scientifically an individual's decision to use a plastic straw versus using a metal straw does not really have the impact on the climate that is needed to kind of, stave off any of the climate crisis that scientists have kind of articulated, that notion of being able to do something personally and individually changes the mind and changes the perspective of an individual for millennials and Generation Z, and therefore they're more likely to support policies they're more likely to support climate policies. So in the same way, if we can figure out what individuals can do personally on the debt and deficit, it's not as though their individual decision-making will be able to, you know, take off $100 of the federal national debt here and we're slowly ticking back from $23 trillion. The effect won't be from that. Instead, the effect and positive benefit would be from the mind of the individual saying, hey, actually, I am making a difference on this in a little small individual way, but now I'm more willing to support, you know, some of the tougher choices we'd have to make now so that in the future we could make investments, as you said, Chase, in infrastructure or in job training programs or in education.
So what you're saying, Tim, is baby steps will help rewire our brains to address these issues, maybe?
Yes, I'm thankful that our brains are wired in a way such that baby steps will help.
There we go. This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Tim Higashi from Brookings. We discussed the research behind a recent panel discussion on how millennials think differently about a lot of issues, but especially climate change and the national debt, and that conversation, which was hosted by Brookings and the Millennial Action Project. Thank you for joining the show, Bob and Tim.
Thanks, Chase.
Thanks, Chase.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.